Accession number 33250, reel 1.
Sir John Wilton, reel 1. When and where were you born?
Switch off. Earlsfield in Middlesex.
And then what date was that you were born?
That was the 21st of October 1921.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a precision engineer, electrical and mechanical. He, amongst other things, he had been apprenticed to the bell tuning business in the East End of London, and he worked for Gillett and Johnson, the electric master clock, which is still running the House of Commons, and he was during the war in the Royal Engineers and was engaged on sound ranging and flash spotting business for the artillery.
And your mother, did she work at all?
She was the lady's maid. That was what she did until they got married during the war in 1916, I think.
Did you have brothers and sisters growing up?
I have an older brother and a younger sister, both now dead. My brother finished up as a general practitioner in Ipswich, and my sister was a high-speed Morse operator during the war, and she was on Montgomery's rear link for the invasion, transmitting high-speed Morse, transmitting and receiving. And after that, she was remustered, as they say, as a typist, because if you stayed with the dots and dashes long enough, you went mad. So they would take you off that after 18 months or a couple of years. She then became a solicitor's clerk in Hindhead, where my mother lived. My father died during the war, when I was in Italy, just before Cassino, so no question of getting any leave for that occasion.
Okay, and what was the area you grew up in like?
It was it was on the edge of London. It was Red Bridge. We lived in a road off Red Bridge Lane, and that at the time was the edge of London. There was a disused gravel pit, and a field, a line of elm trees and so forth on the other side of the road. We went out of our house into countryside, but that was very rapidly built up during the 30s while we lived there, and I fear that Redbridge Lane is now a long way from the edge of London.
And did you have any hobbies or play any sports when you were a child?
Well, I played the usual things that one played at school. I was never very good at any of them, but I played rugger, which was my best game, because I was big and strong. But my eyesight was not very good, and it was useless for things like cricket. And I was as I said, either big and strong rather than agile and athletic and gymnastic. I was never gymnastic. So that too affected my military career to some extent, you'd find.
And where did you go to school?
I went to I started school in the mixed infants in Hackbridge, near Carshalton, where my parents were then living. But then we moved to Ilford, and I went to to a school called Highlands School. I guess it's still there. I went into the infant school first. That was I was about 6 years of age, I suppose, and from there into the 7 to 14 or 7 to 11 if you passed the 11 plus, which was then called the scholarship. Well, I did, and I was sent to Wanstead High School, which was the nearest secondary school. I was in their area.
Did you have any particular favourite subjects while you were at school?
I was always very much better at letters than at figures. I was always much better at language and so forth than I ever was at science. So in those days that was regarded as quite normal, and I stayed with English, French, history, Latin, that kind of syllabus.
And what age were you in? When did you leave school?
I was in the sixth form when war broke out, and the school was split up and evacuated, and I went first to Ipswich and then to Malden in Essex, where I had where there was a very small group of us who got very good personal tuition, and I got a scholarship to Oxford at the beginning of 1940. And the deal then was that you could take up a scholarship like that. You could go to Oxford for a few terms. You got deferred enlistment, deferred call-up, on condition, first, that you studied seriously, second, that you joined up some sort of that you did some sort of national service. What you had to do was to go to the nearest military depot and attest. You were then told that in due course you would hear when you were to be called up, that the condition as far as the university was concerned was that if you would be examined on your studies during those terms, and provided that you signed on for national service and survived, you would be entitled to a degree at the end of the war, based upon the two forms of study and national service. Well, I did survive.
And what were you studying while you were at Oxford?
Modern history. That's to say, from the beginning of the reign of George III, basically, but 18th, 19th century.
And did the war affect life in Oxford much?
Oh yes, enormously. I would have had the greatest difficulty in being able to afford to go to Oxford at all, even with a scholarship. It was reckoned that £240 a year was the minimum that it was sensible for anybody to try to go to Oxford on. I never got as much as that. I had £100 scholarship from the college, and I thought that I would get £100 from the county, from Essex, but I was told that they disapproved of people going to Oxford unless their parents were in a position to support them properly while they were there. So they would reduce the grant from £100 to £80. So I was looking at going to Oxford on £180 a year, which everybody said wouldn't work. However, my headmaster was not a man to be lightly put off, and he said, well, you should write to... And he gave me a list of charities that I could write to, from whom I managed to drum up another £40 a year. So I was still a bit short of the optimum 240. But that, as it turned out, didn't matter, because during wartime a lot of expensive activity and lifestyle at Oxford ceased, and you took your exercise by joining the officers' training corps, and you didn't have any opportunity to join expensive clubs, most of which closed down for the war. You could play tennis on the college grounds, you could play squash on the college courts, so you ate all your meals in hall anyway, because they had your ration book, and so it was possible during the war.
Were there air raids at all in Oxford while you were there?
Not while I was there. We used to do fire watching on the college tower. You'd go up there and take it in turns to keep an eye on any possibility of something falling and setting light to the thing. But that was the nearest we got to trouble of that sort. It was rather livelier when I went home to Barnet, where my parents, where my parents had moved, because the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, for which my father worked, had moved their workshops and their maintenance organisation out of the East End, Poplar, where they were before the war, and so Boreham Wood was where it settled, and that incidentally was very useful, because my father's workshop, which claimed that it could make anything that any lifeboat in the country might need if it wasn't available off the shelf, was a very skillful team of operators, and as the demand for their services was very patchy. You couldn't tell when something was going to go wrong with a lifeboat which would require their intervention. They had spells under really quite serious underemployment, and my father made an arrangement with de Havillands down the road to make bits of the Mosquito aircraft for them. So that was a very useful for both.
And you were, so did you experience air raids then while you were at home?
Well, there were air raids, and on London at that time, you never knew where a bomb might fall. Even if you weren't in Docklands, there were always random bombs here and there. The house, in the house that we occupied, it stood on a newly built road, which was a cul-de-sac. And periodically during the air raids, an anti-aircraft gun would whiz down the road, loose off a lot of rounds, and go away again. It was all part of the anti-aircraft setup at that time.
Did your family have a shelter at home?
I spent one vacation digging a large hole in the back garden. But they never used it. At least they never used it for protection. My father filled it up with compost and grew splendid vegetables on it.
And was the blackout and things like rationing in effect?
Blackout rationing was a way of life. From the time that we, from the beginning of the war onwards.
You mentioned joining the OTC at Oxford. What sort of training did they give you?
The OTC, the Officer Training Corps, they took you through what was called Certificate A and Certificate B. So in order to get any further, you had to get Certificate B, the second stage. But in 1941-42, things were going badly. In Europe and in North Africa and in the Far East, and the theory was that if you got Certificate B while you were at Oxford, which was expected of you, you would be potential officer material. They didn't promise, that wasn't it. It was not automatic. You were supposed then to do a period in the ranks and then move on to what was called an OCTU, an officer cadet training unit, at the end of which you would get a commission if you passed. But by 1942, when I finally was called up, there was clearly a very much greater demand for officers than they had expected, and I went straight to OCTU, and after 6 months I was commissioned and posted at once to a regiment.
Have they given you military training at Oxford before you joined the army at all?
The officer cadet training unit, at university was military training by regular soldier instructors, splendid sergeant major, a weapons training sergeant, and so on. We were drilled, we marched, we were taught to handle the rifle, the Bren guns, the Tommy gun, and so forth. We got lectures on various aspects of military life and so on. This is what is meant by certificate B. You were then tested in that, in map reading, in law and so forth, and you had to pass in order to go on to the OCTU, which was the the training at the end of which lay a commission. So I got through all those hoops. The only other thing I did while in Barnet was that I joined the Home Guard, and when I was home on leave, not home on leave, when I was home on vacation, not up at Oxford, I attended various parades of the Home Guard. And I found, to my surprise, that I could shoot much better with a rifle there than I could anywhere else, because they had American rifles with circular sights rather than the U-sight. And as I said, my eyesight was never very good. But I found that with that particular sort of sight, I was much better, and that luckily was the sight that was on the Bren gun too. So I did a little better at musketry than I ever expected to do.
Did you undertake any other duties with the Home Guard? Or?
No, because I was never there for more than a few weeks at a time. Then I'm back to Oxford, and then back again. It was not a very. I didn't make much contribution to the national defence. I on one occasion while I was home, we were taken to see a couple of pillboxes that had been built, and told that in case of an invasion, we would have to make our way to these places and stand by to repel. But that, as I said, fortunately never happened.
Okay. So when was it that you were called to join the army?
I was called up and sent to the 164 OCTU in Barmouth in Wales at the beginning of in January 1942.
And what was the camp at Barmouth like?
It wasn't a camp. It was a series of hotels on the seafront, which as they were no longer going to be used by people having summer holidays, were taken over by the army, and you got one company in each of four hotels, and they went a company, a course at a time. It was always a course just finishing and another one just beginning.
And so what was your accommodation like in the hotels?
Oh, fairly primitive. Couple of wooden beds in a smallish room.
And did they? What was your reception like on arrival?
Oh, exactly as you expect. You're lined up. You're issued with clothes. You're asked the size of your boots and so forth. And then you're marched off to your billet, and it was the recognised army procedure. It was all right. it came as a bit of a shock, perhaps, to some young people like myself who'd never been in this in the armed forces. But I came of a fairly military family. My grandfather was the regimental sergeant major of the 14th Hussars, and one of my uncles, who was a lancer, was killed at the Battle of Mons, right at the very beginning of the 1914 war. My father was a sapper. I heard about military life. I hadn't experienced it, but
it wasn't a complete shock for you.
It wasn't.
You settled down. Okay.
Yes, it wasn't completely unknown territory.
What uniform and equipment did they issue you with?
Oh, battle dress, rifle, and equipment, steel helmet, gas mask, the usual.
And excuse me, what were the rations like at Balmouth? What did they give
you? Oh, all that you could eat. It was fairly heavy stuff, but we were well fed. You could, if you ate everything that was provided, feel distinctly full up when you tried to fasten your belt back on. But the main thing, as far as I was concerned, was that I had the very good fortune to share a room with a corporal from the Duke of Wellington's regiment, a man called Tommy Evers, who took me in hand, who explained to me how to lay my kit out, what to do, what this was, what that was. That again, you see, is a normal part of life. When you enlist, you're in the ranks, there is always somebody there who is telling you what to do. It's very nice if it can be told to you in a sensible and intelligent fashion by somebody that you get on with, and that was magnificent. And Tommy Evers, who was, as I say, a corporal in the Duke of Wellington's regiment, was commissioned and finished the war as a lieutenant colonel. He went back to Dewsbury in Yorkshire, where he lived, where he had been driving a corporation tram before he was called up, and he astonished the locals by saying he wanted his job back. But I think that was no more than a political gesture. He became he was elected as a councillor and did very well. I didn't see anything of him, but years later in the diplomatic service, I had as a great friend a chap from Dewsbury who became ambassador at Cairo eventually, who said on one occasion, when I mentioned Tommy Evers, said, "Evers, you knew Evers? So he's a councillor in Dewsbury, a great chap." So, extraordinary coincidence.
And so, should we look at the? I'll just stop this film.